Thank you, Charles. Thanks for the memory of Brother Lewis. Been a while since I've thought of him and that song. He meant a lot to a lot of people. Oh, that's my title. I didn't do a PowerPoint. So y'all are really going to be here for a while tonight. We're not going to be here all that long. If you want to follow along with me, we're going to look at the funniest book in the Bible. The book in the Bible that does not contain the name of God anywhere in it. But the hand of God is all over it. If you're not familiar with the book, it's the book of Esther. Perhaps the last book written in the Old Testament. The reason for that is because, and while you're turning, make your way to Jeremiah 29 before you make your way over to Esther. Children of Israel were going to be in Babylonian captivity for 70 years. This is after those 70 years. Two groups have already returned to the promised land and already started the process of rebuilding the temple, rebuilding the wall, and reestablishing the nation in the promised land. The majority stayed behind and stayed in Babylon, but it was no longer Babylon. Now it was the Medo-Persian Empire. And they stayed. I've always liked Brother Franklin Camp's thoughts with regard to the book of Esther. He thinks that having now been in this place of captivity for a century, with two groups already having come back, Brother Camp says the book of Esther was written and the events in it occurred because God was in essence saying, I told you to go back home, now get up and get back. But a majority of them didn't go back, and the Jews from this point on will scatter all over the world. And they had for a good part of that anyway. Before they went into captivity, God instructed them in the book of Jeremiah chapter 29, verses 4 through 7, to do these things. While they are in the land of their enemy, while they are in the land that destroyed them, while they are in the land of Babylon. And God says to them, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what those gardens produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there. Do not decrease. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. Getting back to, what do we do when we're in the middle of a culture war? What do we do when we're in a land that we no longer recognize? What do we do when we're in a land that we wish wasn't like it is? Well, God told the children of Israel exactly what to do and exactly how to be. And he described for them in Jeremiah that they were to be in this land where they were going to be captives. They were to be good citizens. I'll invite you to skim through me through the book of Esther. Skim with me through the book of Esther. I'm going to just hit highlights, but I want you to notice something as we go through. I'll be reading from the New International Version. I go back and forth between the New International and the American and the English Standard Version. The ESV, in the English Standard Version. I go back and forth between those. I read several, and I go back and forth I stayed primarily, I guess, with the NIV because it's what we use with our kids when they go to Mobile for the convention, and I write the questions because it was determined that that's what they would do. But I love different translations and love reading from them. I'm always asked, which one are you reading from? And I say, don't worry about buying it because I may not read from it next week. And but I go back and forth, which absolutely destroys your ability to memorize. Of course, there would be people who say you've never had a memory to memorize, and they would be accurate. According to the New International Version, the other translations will use a different word. These events take place during the reign of Xerxes. Others will say Ahasuerus. That is the other name for him. So the events that take place begin at about 486, and the time period for his rule was 486 to 464 BC. And these events take place over a long period of time. They take place over a few years. And Xerxes was the man who was the leader and the king of the Medo-Persian Empire, and the Bible will tell us that his reign was from India to Kush. He had a large territory. A large territory that he was the ruler over. He gave a feast, invited all of the people to come to the palace in order to enjoy the things that the king was going to supply for everyone, and people came. They came and everything was given in great abundance, and they feasted for days and days and days. And after King Xerxes had been feasting for a long period of time, and he had become happy with his drinking, he decided to show off his wife. So he invited Queen Vashti to come down so that he might show all of the guests how beautiful she was. He invited her to come down wearing her crown, to enable everyone to see what a beautiful woman King Xerxes was married to. She said no. She said she would not do that. We have no idea why. We don't know why. We don't know what offended her, if it was the request or if it was something that had been done earlier and she was still mad about it. We don't know what it was, but kind of keep this thought in the back of your mind as we go through. Well, this troubled the king greatly, and so he called in all of his advisors to ask them, what do we do? The queen has said no to the king, and so now what do we do? And those advisors said to him, it's not just you. If word gets out what Vashti has done toward you, all of our wives will do that to all of us. And none of our wives will listen to us at all. Something has to be done, or this whole land is going to turn into turmoil and the wives will not listen to us one bit. And he said, well, what do I do? And they said, remove her from being queen. And that he did. He removed her from being queen, and she would no longer be the queen. In order to be able to save the relationship of the men that were under him and their wives. And after he'd sobered up a bit, he remembered all that had happened and all that took place. And he called in his people and he asked them, what do I do? Because I no longer have Vashti as my wife, so what do I do now? And the idea came to one of them, why don't you have what we would call a beauty contest? Gather all of the virgins in your kingdom and have them to come, and you pick out, after you've looked at them and seen them, you pick out the one that you want and marry her. And the thing sounded like a great idea to him. So that's what he did. Among those that were chosen was a young woman who was a Jew. She happened to be the cousin of a man by the name of Mordecai. And she, being the cousin of Mordecai, was brought before the king in order to be a part of this beauty contest, so to speak, to see what would occur and what would happen. Mordecai, we are given some unusual information about him. With regard to Mordecai, we are told that this is a man who was from the tribe of Benjamin. And his ancestor was a man by the name of Kish. Does that ring a bell? Does that remind you of something? Well, if it does, hold on to it a minute. And if you know it, don't tell anybody else. But you, well, that's not really true. That's not a part of it. But if somebody says, what does it mean, then you can tell them if you want to. But we're beginning to see something now that is going to unfold for us all through this. Mordecai instructs Esther, don't tell them who you are, but go. And he spends time now at the palace looking after her. Spends a great deal of time there. While he is at the palace, during about the second time that the preparation for seeing the king, which would take a year, because they had to go through all these preparation rites of getting cleaned and perfumed up and beautified and everything, and it would take a year before they would be presentable to go before the king. And during one of these times when she was doing that, Mordecai was in a position near the palace to overhear two of the guards talking. And those two guards had become angry at the king, and they had decided they were going to kill him. When Mordecai heard about that, he told Esther. And he said, make sure the king knows. And so word got to the king about this. And what was told to those who reported it to the king was investigated, and they found it to be true. And so the two men who were going to kill him were put to death. And everything that was done about this event was written down in the chronicles of the king. And every detail of it was there, including Mordecai's part with regard to it. Esther is given information that she needs from the man that's in charge of her. Who put him in charge of her? Why was he selected? Why was he selected to be with her? The man who was in charge of her, she trusted. And so she didn't do like evidently a lot of the other women did. When it came her time to go before the king, she took his advice and asked for only the things he suggested she ask for. And you can imagine with somebody, all of this group of people coming to the king and the king's entire wealth and entire fortune open to everyone, what kind of things people would ask for. And I get the idea that material things were not high on the list. And she asked just for the man who was caring for her, told her to ask for. And the man loved her, thought highly of her, thought she would be perfect for the king. And so she went before the king. She went before the king, and the king loved her more than he loved all of the others. And he decided to take Esther to be his wife. There's a thing that's being described for us here. And this thing fits in with how God works. We're beginning to get a little picture of this God who is not named in this book. And we're beginning to see some things that he's doing. Because none of these characters are doing it. None of these individuals are doing it. But things are happening. And if you notice where you are now, and we're in chapter, at the end of chapter 2, and we're about to head into chapter 3. And when we get to chapter 3, the villain of the book is named for the first time, and his name is Haman. But he hasn't had anything to do with anything coming up to this. And I want you to look right now, before we get to chapter 3, where Mordecai and Esther are. They are both known to the king. They are both thought of highly by the king. And because of what has been done by Mordecai, and wow, what has occurred with Esther, they are both, even though they don't know it, and maybe Esther does, but it's not overwhelmed by it, but they are both in positions of power and don't realize it yet. We call this providence. And providence can never be seen from the point where you are looking to the future. Providence is always seen from where you are looking back to the past. How did these things happen? What brought about all this? How did this occur? And that's what we're seeing now in this book that does not name God. And we're seeing it occur. And the funny stuff is on the way. And it's all focused around this man, Haman. In verse 1 of chapter 3, the Bible will say, after these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than all of the other nobles. He became, I would imagine, pretty close to what we would call second only to the king. But look at this man. He is Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Have you ever heard of a king called Agag? The king's name, Agag, is not the king's name given when he was born. It's the title of the king of the Amorites. That's who this is. He is a descendant of the Agags, the kings of the Amorites, which takes us all the way back to the book of Exodus. Because when the children of Israel left Egypt, in the Exodus, the first nation to attack them were the Amorites. And God became so angry that he said, I will not stop punishing the Amorites from generation to generation to generation. That was the battle where Aaron and Hur and Moses went up on top of the mountain. And as long as Moses had his arms in the air, the children of Israel were victorious. But when his arms grew tired and he lowered his arms, then they would begin to lose. Until finally Aaron and Hur held up his arms so that the battle was given to the children of Israel. When Saul, the son of Kish, Mordecai is a Benjamite, same tribe as Saul, and he's referred to as a son of Kish. Is he a descendant of Kish, who was the father of Saul? I think the Bible is trying to get us to make that connection. And now we're introduced to a man who was an Amorite and who was a descendant of the kings of the Amorites. And his name is Haman. How does this come about? How does God bring these two guys together? What all is happening and what all is occurring? Well, when he was made second to the king gave orders that everybody was to bow down and honor Haman wherever they saw him and wherever they found him. Well, there were a group of guys that got to noticing that they all did that except Mordecai. And so they would ask him, why don't you bow down to Haman? And evidently, for a while, Mordecai refused to answer. He wouldn't tell them. He wouldn't say why he wouldn't bow down to Haman. But eventually, it came out in some conversation that someone had with him. And when they heard what he said, they reported it to Haman to see if that would work, if he had a legitimate reason. What was his reason for not bowing down to Haman? He simply said, no, I won't bow down to him. I'm a Jew. I worship God. I'm a Jew. And I take that, I worship God, to be the meaning that would have been with Mordecai behind that. I don't bow down to him. I bow down to God. So they reported that to Haman to see if that would stand up. Will this hold water? When Haman heard what was said, he got to watching Mordecai, and the more he watched him, the angrier he got. The more he watched him, the more he hated him. He decided, I'm not going to do something just to him. I'm going to kill all of his people. I'm going to get rid of all of the Jews. And that's what he decided he would do. So he went into the king, and he told the king, there's a group of people in your country, in your empire, that don't obey your laws. They don't listen to you. They don't honor you. And it would be in the best interest of the king if the king would get rid of all of those people. And I will offer 10,000 talents of silver to help pay for that job to be done if you will give me permission to do it. Xerxes doesn't know what's going on. He's listening to an advisor that he trusts, and he simply says to the advisor, go, take whatever you need from the treasury, get it done. If there are people out there that are not listening to me and to my rules, then okay, that's fine. Go ahead, just take care of it. So he started the process. Started the process of figuring out by casting lots. That's pur in that language, in the language of the Medes and Persians. To cast lots was to cast pur. Later on, there's going to be a feast at the end of the book called the Feast of Purim. It's named Purim after the word pur, meaning the casting of lots. And that's what Haman was doing in order to figure out the date when they were going to destroy all of the Jews and all of the empire of Xerxes. Adar became the month. It corresponds to our February or March. And the 13th day of the month became the day. Reports were written. Banners were written. Signs went out all over the kingdom. On the 13th day of the month of Adar, all people are to attack all of the Jews and kill every single one of them in all of the entire empire. Those that hated the Jews rejoiced. The Jews themselves were terrified. They wondered what was going on. They immediately began to pray and talk. And there was confusion, the Bible says, in the capital city, because the Jews were there and they were important. And there was confusion there, and there was confusion in other places. Mordecai goes to the palace. And he says, I need to see Esther. And they say, after some delay, finally, he gets to talk with Esther. And he tells her, you need to go talk to the king. You need to stop this. You need to do what you can with the power that you have to make sure that the Jews are not killed on the 13th day of Adar. And she said, how can I do that? If I go before the king without being requested, if I go before the king without his permission, he will kill me. And he makes the statement, how do you know that you haven't come to the kingdom for just this event? Just such a time as this. Go and talk to the king. We're going to come back to this in a minute, but I want you to be aware of the story as we go through. But she says, okay, I'll do that. Then she says this, go and fast. Don't eat any food. Tell the others around you to fast, not to eat any food. I will fast, and I will not eat any food, and those that are with me will fast, and we will not eat any food. And then I will go before the king, and if I die, I will die. What were they doing when they fasted? Even though his name is not mentioned, what were they doing when they were fasting? They were praying to God. So she goes before the king, and when the king sees her standing out, even though she's unannounced, he's delighted to see her and invites her to come in. And when she comes in and they talk, he says, what is the request that you want? Even up to half of my kingdom, what do you want? She says, I want one thing. I want you and Haman to come to my house to eat a meal. We'll do that. We'll do that right away. The king goes, gets Haman, tells him, we're going to Esther's house and we're going to eat a meal. And he is rejoicing. He's overwhelmed. And he goes to the place and they eat and they have a great time. And at the end of the meal, the king looks at Esther and says, now what is it that you want? Name whatever it is and you will have it. And she says, what I want is for you and Haman to come back and eat another meal with me tomorrow. And they say they will. And Haman goes out of that place walking on cloud nine. He is so happy and so delighted. And then he sees Mordecai. And Mordecai won't even lift his eyes up to look at him. Pays him no attention. Won't bow down to him. And Haman becomes so angry and so furious, he goes home. All the things that I've got that are honoring me, I'm second only to the king. I've been to the house of Esther, the queen. We've eaten, and she's invited me to come back tomorrow, but I can't rejoice in any of it because of that man Mordecai. And his wife and his friends that are with him, and they hear his complaining, say, well, why don't you put a pole 75 feet high in your backyard and hang him on it? A pole or a gallows, either way you want to look at it. But he was going to be impaled on it. And Haman said, that's a great idea. I'll do that. And he started construction on it right away. And then he went to the king so that he would be able to ask permission to take care of Mordecai. That happens. How did this happen? For some reason, that night, the king couldn't sleep. And when he couldn't sleep, he got up and was reading from the Chronicles or having them read to him. And somebody read to him the story of what had occurred with Mordecai. How Mordecai uncovered the guys that wanted to kill the king. And he asked those that are there and are reading to him, was anything ever done for Mordecai? They say, no, not one thing was ever done for Mordecai. Well, who's out in the hall waiting? Is anybody out there? Yeah, Haman's out there. Tell Haman to come in here. So Haman comes in, and when the king sees him, he says, Haman, tell me what you would do if there was somebody the king wanted to show the greatest honor possible to. And Haman says to himself, who does he want to honor more than me? So he says, well, here's what you need to do. What you need to do is to take a robe that you have worn, a crown that has set on your head, and a horse that you have ridden, and put your crown on the head of the man you want to honor and your robe on the man that you want to honor, and put him on the horse that you have ridden. And then take the highest ranking official that you have in your kingdom and have that man to lead that individual around the city shouting at the top of his voice, "This is what the king does to the man that he wants to honor." And the king says, "That's great. Go get Mordecai and do that to him." Now, you don't think God has a sense of humor? You don't think when we read from Psalms 2 this morning and all those other Psalms, that when it says God laughs, you don't think that occurred? You don't think that happens? Can you imagine Haman walking every step of the way, shouting at the top of his voice, "This is what God, not God, but what Xerxes does to the man that he wants to honor." As soon as he finished the rounds, he ran home, defeated, shamed. And as soon as he got home, he says, "This is what happened." His wife said to him, "If he's a Jew, and this is what happened, you're already defeated, and you're going to be destroyed." Who put those words in her mouth? Who put that thought, that idea, that conclusion into her brain to say to her husband? And while she's talking, the knock on the door. And the knock on the door, it's time to go to Esther's house. And he comes out, he goes to Esther's house. When they get there, the king and then Haman eat. Haman probably not as happy as he'd been before, but he's at Esther's house. And then the king says, "What do you want? Name whatever it is that you want and I'll give it to you." And she said, "All I'm asking for, king, is my life. I'm asking that I not be killed, nor my people be killed." And Xerxes rises and says, "Who in the world is planning to kill you and your people?" And she says, "This wicked man, Haman." As soon as she says it, the king walks out to the balcony. And Haman begins to beg for his life. And he falls on the couch that Esther is on. At the same moment, the king walks back into the house and says, "Look, he's even trying to molest my wife." And the men that are there, who evidently have no love for Haman, says, "And guess what, king? He's been building a gallows 75 feet high." And the king says, "Well, take him and go hang him on it." And they do. And the whole thing becomes that tragic humor that comes to him. But they have a problem. The law to kill all the Jews in the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the month, was a law according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which means it cannot be voided. It cannot be annulled. It cannot be taken away. And so they ask, "What do we do?" And King Xerxes tells Mordecai, "You take the wisest men in my kingdom and you figure out what to do to get around this without voiding it. Because the law can't be voided, but you figure out what to do to get around it." So they worked. They worked for a few days and they figured it out months before the month of Adar came. Plenty of time to send word to all the provinces of the king. And here's their solution. Their solution was, on the day, the 13th of Adar, the Jews have every right to defend themselves and to destroy anyone who tries to harm them. And so that's what they did. There was rejoicing among the Jews. They were allowed the ability to defend themselves and to destroy those that would come against them to do them harm. in all of the provinces of his entire territory, 75,000 people were killed who came to fight against their enemy, the Jews. But the Jews were able to defend themselves. And because they were able to defend themselves, and it was obvious that it was Xerxes' wish that they defend themselves, many of the people joined with them to help them to defend themselves. All through this, we see all of these different things that occur that are just evidence after evidence of the providence of God. Who were they praying to when they fasted? How did Esther become the queen? How did the king just happen to say, "Come on in"? How did the king just happen not to be able to sleep the night before Haman comes to him to ask for permission to king to kill Mordecai? And how is it that Haman just happens to be outside just as the king sees and remembers what Mordecai had done, and he asks the question, "Who's out there?" How does all this take place? How does all this occur? We don't know until we look back. And we understand that his name is not in the book, but he's all over it. God is at work in the way he works and in the way he does things. And what a comforting thing it is that our God, while we might call that nothing in it miraculous, out of the ordinary, just circumstances that would have happened, seem to have happened anyway. And there's one in control. And he's in control of everything. And he always is. So we keep trusting him and praying to him. And the book of Esther helps us with it. There may be somebody here tonight who is ready to come home to God or ready to come into Christ. And if you desire to respond to his invitation this evening, we want to offer that invitation to you as together we stand and as we sing.